Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Wall Street woes a long slog anniversary race center stage and unrest in Tibet this week. 5 years into Iraq, President Bush said, carry on.
Removing Saddam Hussein from power was the right decision, and this is a fight America can and must win.
Under the gun for a fiery mentor, Barack Obama spoke to race and realities.
I can no more disown him than I can disown the black community. I can no more disown him than I can disown my white grandmother.
In Tibet's capital and beyond, Tibetans were in the streets.
We want freedom from China!
And China's premier, Wen Jiabao, blasted the Dalai Lama.
There is ample fact, and we also have plenty of evidence, proving that this incident was organized, premeditated, masterminded, and incited by the Dalai Lama clique.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. Joining us today from Washington is Joseph Williams. He's the Deputy Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe's Washington Bureau. Joe, it's great to have you with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for being invited.
Bill McKenzie joins us from Dallas, Texas. He's editorial columnist for the Dallas Morning News. Bill, welcome back to On Point.
Hello, Tom.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic, as opposed to Pacific Monthly. Jack, thanks for being here.
Made a big splash there, Tom.
Yeah, big splash.
Hello to you, and hello, Joe and Bill.
What a week. I'm not even sure where to begin to dive in here, but Joe Williams may be with you. A huge political week, both for what we've seen with the Democrats in their primary struggle over Michigan and Florida and what to do with that count, and maybe above all with Barack Obama and his effort to get a handle on the Reverend Jeremiah Wright controversy. How do you think he's doing at the end of this week, Joe?
Well, that largely depends on who you ask. If you ask hardcore Democrats, he's doing okay. If you ask some less committed Democrats to his campaign, it's raised some serious questions. It also has been indicated in polls that it's lost a little bit. It's taken a little bit of the luster off his campaign, and his negatives are rising, and Hillary Clinton has managed to outpace him in the polls for the first time in several months.
And Bill McKenzie, you're watching from Dallas, Texas, and listening along with the rest of the country. You've got a more conservative bent. Here's a Democratic contender for the nomination. What did you think of his message, Bill?
Well, I think he, for the most part, did a very good job, and I would say he's probably in a better position at the end of this week, at the beginning of this week, when the right stuff was exploding. You know, I probably would like to have heard more, put more of the onus on Reverend Wright, and I'm not saying that Senator Obama didn't. He certainly did. But if we're going to really have this national conversation that he rightly says we need to have, and I think he is uniquely situated, he, Barack Obama, to help lead us in that conversation because of his story and his own personal history. But if we're going to have it, we aren't going to have it for very long if we have either a Reverend Wright out spewing or a Pat Robertson, let's say, out demonizing. You know, maybe those will be the opening statements of both sides in those conversations, but we can't really sustain a long conversation with that level of anger.
He didn't duck it entirely. It may not have been quite enough for you, but let's listen to where Barack Obama in that speech in Philadelphia talked about what he called the profound mistake of his longtime minister, now retired, Jeremiah Wright.
The profound mistake of Reverend Wright's sermons is not that he spoke about racism in our society. It's that he spoke as if our society was static, as if no progress had been made. As if this country, a country that has made it possible for one of his own members to run for the highest office in the land and build a coalition of white and black, Latino, Asian, rich, poor, young, and old, is still irrevocably bound to a tragic past.
Jack Beatty, it was some speech. You had people talking about Abraham Lincoln and John F. Kennedy, and there was Barack Obama. Do you think he cleared the hurdle that his own minister threw in front of him when all the videotape came out of these super hot moments?
Well, he cleared one hurdle, the hurdle of presidentialness. You know, he may not get to be president, but his speech on the burden of race in America, that was a presidential act. It was what great presidents do, what Lincoln did in his second inaugural, what Wilson did in his war message to Congress, what JFK did in his speech after the church bombing in Birmingham, when, and I remember this, he said, "We are confronted primarily with a moral issue. It is as old as Scripture and as clear as the Constitution." The president, FDR said, first of all, is an educator. The great presidents frame the big issues in big terms. They speak from a high plane and ask us to join them up there, to see with them, you know, the rights and wrongs embedded in issues. And sometimes, and we got this from Obama, the wrong in the rights and the right in the wrongs. And, you know, in the intellectual desert of the Bush presidency, he took us up there to see bitter truths about slavery, the legacy of it, white supremacy, black alienation, white resentment. He practicing the politics of truth, he warned against the politics of distraction. The question is, will white Americans reject him not for his stand on the issues or his experience, but because the felt truth of the black experience here, as magnified in Reverend Wright's anger, that is because that's just too much for them to bear. That's a very haunting question. You know, I was listening to All Things Considered, to Morning Edition, and they had a story in their StoryCorps from a woman in Alabama. Every black family has a story like this. Her grandmother painted her fingernails red when she was a girl in 1910 in Alabama, just to see what they looked like. She worked as a maid and got the nail polish from the discard pile of the white woman who employed her. And she went into a store to buy something, and the man there said, "What are you doing with white women's fingernails?" And grabbed her and took pliers and pulled her nails out. That's America. That's what's happened in this country.
I guess. Kind of unbelievable.
Can I jump in a second?
Yes, Bill.
Echo it, because I think Jack is really putting his finger on something that's very important, and that is why I do think Barack Obama is very uniquely situated to help us in this conversation. And it's really powerful watching that speech this week, and it just dawned on me in a different level. Mm-hmm. You know, we're watching a guy who is both African-American and both white, mm-hmm. And he is speaking to two sides of not of America, but of himself. And doesn't happen very often in our national life to have a leader like that who has that. Having said that, and Jack raised a very good point about, will white Americans be able to come to him because he does have that ability to lead us, or will they want to move away from that? I agree with that. I actually think there are a lot of moderate Republicans who are likely to come to him because they do think he can lead us. However, and we've talked about this on this show before, I don't see him being able to win those moderate Republicans that I think he needs on issues, on many issues, outside of that of racial reconciliation.
Joe Williams, you grew up African-American in this country. You've written eloquently about that perspective on this race and this man. What did you see of and in these racial communities this week? A common understanding? Barack Obama pulling everybody together, or something different?
Well, I thought it was more of a teachable moment, or at least he tried to frame it as a teachable moment, because a lot of what Wright has been saying has not shocked any African-American people who I know. Most of my black friends say, yeah, we've heard that before. Most of my black friends actually even speak about that. But it's mostly behind closed doors, not in mixed company. It's something that we talk about amongst ourselves. And the controversy erupted mostly because white America got a chance to listen to how black Americans feel about this country. That is very conflicted. There's a lot of bitterness, as Obama mentioned. There's also a lot of hope and a lot of pride. There's a woman who I'm friends with, who is African American, who is a black female lesbian. And if anybody has a set of grievances towards America, then you would expect her to be it. Mm. But she gets into a lot of discussions with a mutual friend who we have, who is an immigrant from Canada, who is not yet acquired citizenship. And most of the discussions turn on, well, why aren't you a citizen yet? You know, why aren't you a member of this country? You know, if you don't like the way things are going here, you can go home. I love my country. I'm very prideful of it. And to have that sort of conflict in a person who has a description that anybody would question, you know, wait a minute, you're all these three things. You're a member of a triple minority almost. You know, how can you express pride in this country? Well, it's probably a micro, in my opinion, it's a microcosm of what he was trying to explain. and whether or not white America will understand and grasp onto that, or just continue to see Wright as a divisive figure and conflate Obama's association with it, with Obama supporting his message, is something that remains to be seen.
Let's hear from a listener right here, Fran in Hilton Head, South Carolina. You're on the air, Fran.
Oh, hi. Listen, I'm Caucasian and I'm 70, but Obama talks to us all. You media need to stop wasting time on the clergy and his grandmother and all that stuff, because we can't be judged on what our family and friends think, and talk about the issues. He's really here to help us all. He can help my English students get their papers, and they will pay all our Social Security. We won't be in the hole in Social Security. And second of all, we need to find out who really ordered that passport investigation. I don't think it was the lower-level people who were fired. And lastly, we should boycott China because of what they're doing in Tibet and not go to the Olympics.
Fran, you got your eye on the whole week's news, and we're going to dive right into it. We're thankful for your call. Thanks for being there. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, shock and awe on Wall Street, 5 years in Iraq, Obama on race, crackdown in Tibet, and more. Bill McKenzie joins us from the Dallas Morning News, Joe Williams from the Boston Globe's Washington Bureau, and Jack Beatty. Let's take a call right here from Matt in Somerville, Massachusetts. Matt, you're on the air.
Hello, folks.
Hi, Matt. What are you thinking?
Well, I thought the Barack speech was amazing. I'll kind of tip my hand before I say my comment. But I was interested in the lack of subtle coverage about some of the things that were in these Jeremiah Wright clips in the media. Can I say the God D word on the radio? Am I allowed?
Well, he said it. We've all heard. He said, forget God bless America. God damn America.
Okay, so he said God damn America. Damning is something that God would do to a group of people if they continued to sin. And it seemed to me similar to things that Jerry Falwell had said after 9/11. You know, some of the context of Jeremiah Wright were, you know, after 9/11, this is America's chickens coming home to roost. There was a similarity to things that Jerry Falwell had said about, I blame the abortionists, I blame the gays, the people for the American way.
So where does that take us today, Matt?
Excuse me?
Where does that take us here now?
Well, Jeremiah Wright had a different litany of things that would cause God to damn this country. Just looking at it from an outsider's standpoint, you can see that if somebody was a hellfire and brimstone preacher and their flock were doing things badly and they wanted them to repent and reform, they would say, don't keep doing these things. Different things from a left-wing preacher than from a right-wing preacher, but a whole list of things that the preacher felt would cause the damnation of their people. This seems to me in the normal mainstream of the kind of fringes of what preaching would be about. And there was very little connecting of these two sides of preaching. And that could also show Americans, white Americans, both maybe everyone would have a revulsion to that, or maybe everyone would find a similarity to that. I'm just saying there was very little subtlety in the analysis in the media of what he was saying.
Matt, let us pick it up. I mean, we sat down with a member of that church in Chicago who teaches theology at the Divinity School, University of Chicago, went through the prophetic tradition. We heard Martin Marty on NPR, the theologian out of Chicago, talking, of course, about the prophetic tradition. Bill McKenzie, you're down in territory where people aren't any stranger to tough messages from the pulpit. What do you think?
Well, I'm going to pick up on this prophetic tradition because it's really kind of tricky being a preacher and a prophet at the same time. And I've talked to a number of different pastors and theologians this week, African-American and white both, about this and how you do it. And I think, number one, it's important to remember if you're the preacher that it's God that does the damning if there's damning. It isn't the preacher that is called to do that. And also, I think it's also important to remember that the Old Testament prophets, when they were pointing the finger at Israel, if you will, it was very clear they loved Israel and they wanted Israel to go to a higher plane. I'm not saying Reverend Wright doesn't love his country. I don't know Reverend Wright. But what you get in the blast, the fiery blast which you hear from him, or the fiery blast you hear from Jerry Falwell, you don't necessarily get the same message of love that you did from someone like Dr. Martin Luther King, where you knew very clearly he wanted to lift his people and his country up to a different place.
Well, so maybe not in these clips.
Right.
Correct.
E.J. Dionne, you should take a look at it, in the Washington Post today, has a column about Martin Luther King. And he quotes King at Ebenezer Black Baptist Church in Atlanta in 1968. And his point is, King spoke in different idioms before different audiences. And King said this, "God didn't call America to engage in a senseless, unjust war, and we are criminals in that war. We've committed more crimes almost than any nation in the world, and I'm going to continue to say it. And we won't stop it because our pride and our arrogance as a nation. But God has a way of even putting nations in their place. And if you don't stop your reckless course, he'll say, I'll rise up and break the backbone of your power." Now, that's that Jeremiad tradition. That's a stronger idiom than you would have heard from King talking to a white audience. But I think in a strange way that shows a continuity here in anger and in the language, doesn't it?
Let me ask Joe Williams, let me put it to you. Let's bring it right down to brass tacks, because after all, Martin Luther King was not running for president. Barack Obama is. Whatever listeners or viewers who are sympathetic or not sympathetic may think, he's got to come up with the majority in November to win. Do those clips, played again and again over the balance of this year, most of it, mean that he can't do that, Joe?
Well, it's going to be very, very difficult. Again, the way I'm sort of gathering in this controversy is that there's no doubt that Wright's language was incendiary, but it's incendiary to people who don't always hear it, and it's incendiary to people who aren't used to hearing it. I mean, you go to most black churches, the language is hyperbole, the language is very, very strong, and you go to a church with a strong political tradition, and it's going to be even worse. I mean, again, black African Americans have very conflicted feelings about this country that white America doesn't always hear, see, reflect on.
Fine, but Barack is running in the whole country.
And he is.
Never mind the general, just in the Democratic primaries, he's got to have enough white voters to bring home the vote if he's going to have it. Can he do it?
And that's exactly the conundrum that he is facing, because it to the untrained ear, to most of the white voters that he needs, this is incredibly grating. It's hard to hear. It's difficult to listen to. And it ultimately could be a significant factor. I mean, you look at the polls, he's lost 7 points to Hillary Clinton in the last week. Is that a coincidence? I'm not sure it is. I don't think that the right episode has done him any favors. It will be an incredible test to see if he can rise above it. The odds, in my opinion, are somewhat longer than they might have been a week ago.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Eric in Boston. Hi, Eric. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing? Great show.
Thanks.
I just think this is outrageous. The Jack Beatty comment at the beginning that whites, first of all, you guys are conflating two issues with whites. I mean, there's white liberals who take the planted axiom that, you know, there's guilt about the racism that's been going on for centuries and so forth. And then there's all the other whites who will hear that speech and be immediately alienated by the fact that, you know, Obama, basically, I wanted to hear him take some responsibility for being in a church that does this. This is not a typical black church. They don't go off about 9/11. The chickens are coming home to roost.
Do you spend a lot of time in black churches, Eric? Are you sure?
Well, it might be a Malcolm X kind of line of looking at it, but I don't. The chickens coming home to roost issue. Mm. But I don't think that's a typical. But there's this issue of Obama was the first black candidate, and he's supposed to. And he's also transcending race. So his whole candidacy became, ironically, about race when he tried to transcend it. Now it could be that a first black candidate has to do that, but when he, in the speech, basically blames everyone except himself, Reverend White, his grandmother, the general, he uses the word animosity, but the general tensions of race between whites and blacks in general, without any mention to the second groups of whites I mentioned, with respect to the fact that Obama has been going to this church for 20 years, and the guy has been saying this stuff, right?
Right. So you're not buying the big speech. You're not going with it here, Eric.
But just on the merits, all you guys are taking for granted. You're like, you're talking about healing the nation and all this stuff. The speech was not about race, it was about right. And it was a perfect moment for him to say, look, this guy is radical. I don't ask my doctor for politics. I don't ask my barber for politics. I don't ask my preacher for politics. We go there for the healing of my soul, etc.
Yeah, hard to pull the two apart when you're there for 20 years. It's true, and yet here's Barack Obama trying to take the country someplace. Bill McKenzie, just be very hard as a political analyst here. Do you think you're going to have so many whites responding like Eric that this won't work? Will you have enough saying Obama's trying to go somewhere here? Let's give him a chance. Let's go with it. How do you see it, Bill?
Well, Joe is saying the polls dropped this week, so I'm not going to quarrel with him on that. I still think that Barack helps himself because he is this cool figure. And if we're going to all sit around a table together and have a national conversation about race, we're going to need somebody who has a cool head that can lead us, because around that table we're going to be lots of different kinds of people, and you can't have an inflammatory leader leading that discussion. Barack Obama is the antithesis of that. He has this cool JFK-like style to him, and I think that is his selling point on the issue of race.
And you say that as a Republican sitting in Dallas. Joe Williams, help us turn the corner here a little bit on the news and what the people probing into Barack Obama's passport records incorrectly. You heard our caller say that doesn't sound accidental to her. It doesn't sound like just a couple of what do they say? Imprudent curious
people.
What's the word in Washington, Joe? Does this look like a dirty tricks campaign or something else?
The word in Washington is you've got to look closely at this. Given the administration that's currently in power, and given the fact that this was fairly sensitive information, a lot of people on the left are saying conspiracy, no doubt. The people on the right are saying, well, we can kind of understand that there were contract players. The big picture is that it shouldn't have happened. There probably should have been closer watchdogs on this, but it also points to a third issue that may or may not come up, and that is the issue of contract players in government agencies. It has happened before. The explanation has been, I think that some people will want a full investigation. Whether or not that happens remains to be seen.
We see here, just coming over on the wires, that Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has apologized herself to Barack Obama. The State Department now saying that officials at the Justice Department are monitoring the State Department's internal investigation into whether three contract workers had a political motive for getting into those records. Jack, what do you hear?
Well, you know, the timing of these entries, January 9th, day after the New Hampshire primary, February 21st, the Democratic debate in Texas, March 14th, the Reverend Wright story breaks. The timing is provocative, let's put it that way. And to add another complication to this, from what I understand, the person in charge of this department, or de facto head of the department, during the time of the first two breaches, was in fact a former Clinton ambassador to Paraguay.
Okay.
Now, there you are. That just adds another dimension of paranoia here.
I don't know what to make of it. And what about on the primary vote count and the fact that it appears now are not going to have new primaries or new counts in Michigan or Florida? Joe Williams, the headlines have been kind of contradictory this week. Obama wrestling with this trouble on the one hand. Hillary, on the other hand, said to have a narrow, difficult road now to the nomination. Is it once again coming back to the superdelegates because of exactly that contradiction, Joe?
It's looking that way, that all roads are going to lead through the superdelegates, and it's a big honking mess that the Democrats hope that they can straighten out by the time of the primaries, but it's very difficult to see exactly how a clear, satisfactory, and fair opinion to everybody is going to be worked out ahead of time.
Bill McKenzie, what do you see on that front? If the Democrats end up going to superdelegates and maybe overriding their own popular primary vote, is that a gift to John McCain?
Well, it probably would be, but I'm not sure that is exactly what's going to happen. All along, I've thought this is a great lesson for students to see how exciting politics can be. The longer it goes, that gets a little harder to defend that position because it's getting kind of hair pulling. I also heard where, if I'm not mistaken, Bill Richardson is coming out to endorse Barack Obama. That is important for the one reason only, and that's the superdelegates. And I we're doing this here, on a Friday. I don't know what it's going to be like on a Monday or a Tuesday as to whether there are going to be other Democratic superdelegates come out and declare their allegiances one way or the other. My hunch is we are going to see some of that. I believe that Richardson may be the first of several to start playing their hands. I thought that was a very significant move from Richardson.
And coming at a critical time for Barack Obama. Joe?
I was just going to say that I agree with that view that Richardson may be one of the next dominoes or first of several dominoes to fall. And if the superdelegates have any influence, it may be towards trying to tilt the race and get it settled before the convention happens.
Let's go to a call from Manchester, Vermont. Rachel, you're on the air.
Hi, I was calling because I wanted to talk about what you guys in the media kind of missed this week. Ken Olbermann seemed the only one who covered it, which was McCain's gaffe, not being able to distinguish between Sunnis and Shiites. Wolf Blitzer on CNN even tried to splice it so it looked like Lieberman wasn't having to correct him. That should have been a huge media issue,
Rachel, it's on our list. Let us pick it up right now if you'd be good enough. Of course, this is the moment when John McCain, who's been traveling in Iraq and the Middle East, he's standing in Jordan with Jordanian archaeology behind him and Joe Lieberman at his side. And he's talking about Al-Qaeda and Iran. He gets it all wrong, but doesn't appear to know it.
Well, it's common knowledge and has been reported in the media that that Al-Qaeda is going back into Iran and receiving training and are coming back into Iraq from Iran. That's well known, and it's unfortunate. So I believe that we are succeeding in Iraq. The situation is dramatically improved, but I also want to emphasize time and again, Al-Qaeda is on the run, but they are not defeated.
And there's Joe Lieberman you can see on the TV screen, standing right at his side, leaning in and whispering to him, correcting him, because, of course, it's not Al-Qaeda that Iran is dealing with.
The Iranians are training extremists, not Al-Qaeda, not Al-Qaeda.
Jack Beatty, not a good moment for the guy who's out there to be proving his foreign policy credentials.
Not a good moment at all. And, of course, the press has found earlier moments. Several times this year he said that and said things like that, almost like that, in the past. No one doubts that if he sits down for a moment and thinks about it, he knows what's what there. But it touches the age issue. Is he just fumbling around out there? And secondly, it just kind of reminds us, well, wait a minute, why isn't he paying attention to these details? Is it that he just likes the idea of war, period? It's enough that there's a war. He doesn't care what the sides are or what the dynamics of it are. He gives that impression. And, he's the first presidential candidate ever, non-incumbent, to run on a promise of continuing indefinitely a war. He sees something positive in it, and it's as if it's enough that it's a war. We don't have to worry about the details.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, a little fun, a little fear, a little infidelity in the news. Again this week, David Letterman made war jokes with Dick Cheney.
Vice President Dick Cheney, you know where he is right now? He's in Baghdad. He visited there, and while he was in Iraq, he said that it's a successful endeavor. At least I think that's what he said. It was hard to hear over the explosions. But
Osama bin Laden issues a new threat to Europe and complains about the Pope as the Danish cartoons of Muhammad run again.
Although our tragedy in your killing of our women and children is a very great one, it paled when you went overboard in your unbelief.
New York's new governor, David Paterson, right out of the gate with marital news.
Both of us committed acts of infidelity. I was jealous, and I exercised poor judgment.
And science fiction great Arthur C. Clarke goes to the great monolith in the sky. Before his death on his 90th birthday, he said he was still waiting for extraterrestrials, for E.T.
I have no regrets and no more personal ambitions. But we are still waiting for E.T. to call us or give us some kind of sign.
Arthur C. Clarke passed on this week at 90. We're joined this hour by Joe Williams, Deputy Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe in Washington, Bill McKenzie at the Dallas Morning News, and Jack Beatty. Let's go to Nashville, Tennessee, and Jim. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My comment is about the lack of foresight on the part of the IOC. It seems to me that the Chinese are inevitably going to repress a number of their citizens either after they protest at the Olympics or round them up beforehand. And it seems that the entire world, I guess, is somewhat complicit in that kind of project, which had to be inevitable. And I bet our government, which professes so much interest in freedom and liberty, won't criticize the Chinese at all. And that's just my thought and my comment this week. Thank you.
Jim, thank you very much. Of course, we saw what tape there was out of Tibet. We heard what there was. Nancy Pelosi starting to talk about it. Let's listen for just a minute here to the Dalai Lama, of course, in a kind of government in exile in India, talking about denying any involvement in recent riots in Tibet.
If Prime Minister, come here and investigate thoroughly all our files, all record my speech, then Prime Minister knows how much distorted by local officials.
So there's the Dalai Lama saying that, you know, it's not him. Earlier this week, the Chinese Prime Minister rejected the Dalai Lama's talk about peace.
This has all the more revealed that the consistent claims made by the Dalai clique that they pursue not independence but peaceful dialogue are nothing but lies.
And then here's Nancy Pelosi, who was out meeting with the Dalai Lama at the end of the week, encouraging the world to speak up for Tibet.
If freedom-loving people throughout the world do not speak out against China's oppression in China and Tibet, we have lost all moral authority to speak on behalf of human rights anywhere in the world.
A big moment for China coming this summer with the Olympics in Beijing. President Bush scheduled to be there as part of all the whoop-de-doo around the Olympics. Joe Williams, any sign of the United States getting really critical here or of President Bush backing away?
No sign of that. It's going to go ahead. There's going to be probably some muted criticism at best, but I don't see them coming out forcefully and saying, no way, we're not going to send our delegation to Beijing, because they see it as an opportunity of sorts, but the crackdown in Tibet is hard to ignore.
Bill McKenzie, how do you look at it? The images are tough, yet there's a limit to them. China's got a pretty good grip on what's coming out of there and what's going in at this point, shutting off different international news sources on the web. Do you see signs of trouble here for the Olympics or something bigger than the Olympics here for our long-term interaction with China?
Well, I don't know if China has a good grip on what's going on in Tibet, because I think you make the argument that China has really made this possible by the way that he's treated the Dalai Lama for so long, you know, for to have a group of people who perhaps have risen up because they're tired of the Dalai Lama's ways of doing things, and they want it in Tibet taken into their own hands. And if China had been a better player of internal politics, maybe they wouldn't have the situation.
You mean tired of the Dalai Lama's peace message over many years and taking it to the streets instead?
Correct. And as far as this Olympics go, you know, I don't think this is necessarily going to stop the Olympics. I'm also in the camp, and this comes after 1980. I really think that if we're going to have these games, we need to go ahead with the this may sound naive, but the athletic part of it. If we've assigned this to Beijing, we know going into Beijing that this is not a place that's going to mirror our concerns about human rights. But let's go ahead with the games. If individual competitors want to pull out, fine. If individual sponsors want to pull out, fine. But you know, where does this stop if you start playing politics at the Olympic level? Somebody's going to come back when we get a Games. I don't know when the next one is in the United States, but somebody can come back and say, well, we didn't like what you did in Iraq, so we're pulling out. So, you know, it never stops.
Jack Beatty, Olympics fully politicized years ago, of course, when the Soviet Union was in Afghanistan. So far, it doesn't look like that's in the cards here.
And that's a puzzle to me. I don't understand why we haven't used, the West hasn't used the leverage of the Olympics to get something on Darfur, to get some concessions there, to get, whereas I've been reading, the Chinese have even been supplying planes to the people who are bombing the refugees, and now Tibet, and there's going to be something squalid in the air, I think, at Beijing when these games go off.
Besides the pollution.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, well, everybody's working on that, I guess. Let's go to Vic in Moline, Illinois. Vic, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Love your show.
Thank you.
I'd like to make 2 points. Number one, although I was offended by what Reverend Wright had to say, I was far more offended by what Bush had to say at the Pentagon trying to defend what he's done in Iraq. Mm-hmm. The second point is that I think if Barack Obama does get elected, I think you're going to see black education scores go up, and you're going to see the black crime rate fall, which I think will do a whole lot to help
Vic, thank you very much for that.
I like the way that guy thinks. it's kind of striking to hear someone say that. And I also wanted to say that the Bush speech at the Pentagon was really kind of remarkable as well, in that he actually acknowledged that there was some public dissent. Mm-hmm. There's wide public dissent, but he still stands by his decision. It's just, you know, 5 years into it and almost 4,000 casualties. That's pretty well. I guess it shouldn't be that surprising that President Bush would stand by it that strongly, but that he would actually remark on that to me was a bit surprising.
And of course, Bill McKenzie, it all looks like it's coming to the next president, whoever that is going to be. A talk of freezing the drawdown this summer, and this is clearly not going to be anywhere near solved by the time George Bush and Dick Cheney simply leave office. George Bush comes back to your state, Bill.
All right. And I'm going to defend John McCain here and quarrel a bit with Jack on this about McCain and his, you know, whether he likes to embrace war or not. You know, I happen to think on the geopolitics of this that McCain is really right. And I say this as somebody who is in the camp. I wish we had followed Bill Clinton's line and given the weapons inspectors 3 more months back in 2003 to see whether or not they're really weapons of mass destruction there. But we are where we are. And I think to naively assume that we can pull out of there in 16 months like Barack wants, or Hillary has her plan to try to get something going within 60 days, not that all would come out in 60 days, assumes that once we're out of there, the situation is going to get better. And I just don't see that being the case. I mean, we do have trend lines that are going on the military front in the right way. We're starting to see some signs on the political front. Even Brookings headed a piece in the New York Times. Michael Hanlon did a couple of weeks ago with some of its benchmarks showing some of the political signs are going in the right way. I am not here to say that we are in a great place in Iraq, but we are appear to be going in the right direction. And if we have kept troops in Western Europe for we kept them 50 years during the Cold War, and we still have troops in Korea, we still have them in Europe, I don't see the wisdom of pulling all of our troops out of Iraq in the next presidency. And I think that is actually a strong suit of John McCain.
Of course, we've heard serious debate on both sides of that. We had General John Johns on this week, longtime counterinsurgency bigwig in the U.S. Army, saying we've got to get the heck out of there. I mean, those troops in Germany, Bill, not exactly facing what U.S. troops are facing in Iraq, and never were after the
no,
end of
but
World
they
War.
Were they were deployed for a very long time in a very tense situation. Correct, they weren't facing daily combat, but they were there to try to keep the peace, or to establish peace, or to move us forward. And I think that if we pull our troops out of Iraq. And I'm not saying we don't draw down. I'm in favor of drawing down. But if we go in the way that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton want us, I think we're making a mistake.
Of course, he said draw down carefully and took heat from Hillary Clinton on that. Let's listen to her for just a moment talking about both John McCain and Barack Obama.
One choice in this election is Senator McCain, who is willing to keep this war going for 100 years. You can count on him to do that. Another choice is Senator Obama, who has promised to bring combat troops out in 16 months. But according to his foreign policy advisor, you can't count on him to do that.
Joe Williams, is Hillary cutting it down the middle and succeeding with that line or not?
Well, I think she's cutting it down the middle. Whether or not she's succeeding, it's really kind of interesting to see that parallel and how she's managed to sort of reconfigure herself on the war, having had to defend her vote to authorize it, and also having to sort of backtrack a little bit once it became clear that the war early on in the campaign, that the war was going to be a significant issue and that a lot of the Democrats wanted out. Now, one of the things I was curious about is that the McCain stumble, words do matter, and it does indicate, you know, as Jack Beatty said, that his age may come up as an issue again, that you're wondering whether or not he's going to have the gravitas to and the mental agility to try to handle all these complex situations, but also the recommendation to get out of Iraq, or the two competing plans to get out of Iraq, don't necessarily say that things are going to be great, but also are looking at the big picture, because the longer we stay in Iraq, the things are not going to at least the violence is not going to be completely down to zero. And it also is taxing the military beyond the breaking point, and it also exposes the U.S. to a lot of other problems elsewhere in the world that they really can't respond to because they're tied down.
Let's go to Nashville again. And Cameron, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. As a Kurdish and speaking in your program and looking like 5 years in Iraq war, I'm really see there's no future for Iraqi, especially looking at the eyes of young people educated in here in USA and wanted to serve my country one day if I go back. So there's a lot of corruptions, uncertainties, and also disappointment when you look at Iraq, especially the new attempt at like the Iraqi, the American armies look like doing this, the armament of the tribes, the Sunni tribes.
Well, but Kamran, the President, General Petraeus, look at the Sunnis who have come to the side of the U.S. military and said, look, this is a very hopeful sign here.
But, Tom, if you look at the history of Iraq for the past 20 or 30 years, what's the problem has happened, Iraq has never been a stable country. It's always been in bloodshed, violence, uncertainty. And what makes it Iraq to be more violent is just like the militia and the tribes you have, the tribes mentality. If you want to say, Iraq, we want to be a democratic state, how you depend on the tribe forces? You arm them, and in the future, maybe they become big obstacle to looking for a good future of Iraq.
Yeah,
I don't see this is going to work, frankly, in the long term. It may be helpful in the short term. I always look at the U.S. foreign policy. In a short term, they help in a small group, but in the long term, these groups will come back and will hurt the United States' interest.
Yeah, Kamran, thanks for your call. Of course, we have the Washington Post's Sudarshan Raghavan on this week, and his reporting has found the U.S. is now paying these Sunni awakening troops $10 a day or something. And at the same time, there are problems emerging with the loyalty of some of the Sunni awakening to kind of the American mission here. We could end up paying the insurgency. Harold's calling from Quincy, Massachusetts. Harold, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'll make it quick. The Democrats have blown it for their presidency by the two states that went early in their primaries. They're going to have a divisiveness if it gets down to it, and then that'll be racially tinged. As far as the preacher is concerned, if he was in the military when it was still segregated, he could die for this country if he couldn't take a leak in a toilet. Good luck.
He was in the U.S. Marines before he was at the pulpit, and Barack Obama reminded us of that. Jack Beatty, but I'm not sure where that goes, except the Democrats who looked, you know, like they sort of had the open road to the White House not so many months ago. It's looking a lot thornier now, Jack.
Yeah, I mean, they've run into the American dilemma, the gap between American creed, our professions, the words written across the street in Philadelphia from where Barack spoke, and the American reality. And Barack reminded people of that. And this election is really going to be a test of that. Can people look beyond this? No one, I think, can believe that Barack Obama believes anything like this about the United States of America. No one. So it's a kind of guilt by association. And from what we've heard, he Reverend Wright raises maybe to the 10th power the kind of anger that is endemic and justified historically in black churches. And white Americans, I think, have got to get that. And if they don't, well, then it seems to me that the gap between our ideals and our professions and our practices will still be there. He can be rejected on other grounds. I agree with Bill McKenzie about that. He's certainly vulnerable on all kinds of issues. But to vote against him for that, that would just be a desolating end to what began as such an uplifting primary.
Bill McKenzie, do you think the GOP will wrap Jeremiah Wright around Barack Obama's candidacy and sink him with it in the general, if he's the nominee?
Right. I think we have to underscore if he's the nominee. I don't doubt there are going to be 527s. There'll be 527s on both sides trying to do things that probably a lot of us don't like. So I'm not going to say that isn't going to happen. Whether it's the official GOP, I don't I don't know if that will be the case or not. I think it could so easily backfire against them that they would be really silly to do it themselves. But I would also caution, though, we're here, you know, at the end of March. These elections are going to go through so many more cycles, not just until November, until the convention. So, you know, what looks hot now and what looks like a perhaps a bad moment for the Democrats, who knows where we're going to be? You know, you remember Bill Clinton was third in the polls in June of 1992 and looked kind of pretty much out of it.
Joe, we've got 20 seconds. What do you see in Barack Obama right now? A survivor or maybe Hillary nosing ahead? How do you see it, Joe?
I see it coming right down the wire. I see it going to the superdelegates, and it reminds me of a line when we're talking about the open road to the White House, that the Democrats never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. And they've got a couple flawed candidates that they've got to really try to figure out what to do with and how to resolve the situation.
Joseph Williams, Deputy Bureau Chief at the Washington Bureau of the Boston Globe. Joe, great to have you. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Bill McKenzie, editorial columnist for the Dallas Morning News in Dallas. Bill, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom, Jack, and Joe.
Jack Beatty, have a great weekend. Thanks for being here, Jack.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.